All right. Thank you all so much for coming. It's really great to see you here. Thank you even more for being the kind of person who wants to come to an event like this. I think if you're like Jules and me, you have been experiencing, especially lately, a deep concern and even maybe alarm over the state of the world and a kind of distress over the grip that what Benedict XVI, before he was Benedict XVI, called the dictatorship of relativism, what a grip it has gotten in our society. And it's important for those who are aware of it, those who are suffering because of the awareness of it, to come together over truth and to realize that we have fellows, we have companions, we have friends, that we're not alone in our love of truth and our desire to root ourselves more deeply in it. And besides having friends, we have been given wonderful teachers like Dr. von Hildebrand, people who have dedicated their lives in a particular way to truth so that they can help us establish ourselves more firmly in it. Many of you, I think, already know that Alice von Hildebrand was the human instrument through which Jules and I received a philosophical vocation. And this was back in Steubenville when we were undergraduates in the mid-80s. She was on the board of trustees at the time, came frequently to campus to give talks and even some courses that we had the blessing and privilege of being able to take with her. And at that point, we were, by grace, already we knew that Jesus was the way, the truth, and the life. But it was in encountering Alice von Hildebrand, in hearing her words, and especially in experiencing her witness, that we began to feel what I can only say is the evangelistic force of an intelligence illumined by faith. It was both a sense of this is real force. I mean, this is culture transforming power. That really affected us. And then it was also the sense of how concretely helpful what she was teaching was in our own lives, in our own perplexities, in our own struggle, in our own effort to understand even our own experience of falling in love and what it meant. It was the illumination of the kind of truth that she was giving us that was transforming for us. And what kind of truth was that? I want to say it was not just any truth. She wasn't just a marvelous physics professor or algebra, you know, all that is very worthy and wonderful. But her truth was the deep truths about the mystery of human life. It was all about the nature and dignity of the human person. Her husband, the late great philosopher Dietrich von Hildebrand, wrote way back already in the 1920s, and this was, of course, at a time when communism and national socialism were beginning to overwhelm Europe. He wrote at the time, quote, "The dignity of the person is written over this period as its objective theme." And he said, even regardless of how few people really understand it and really feel it, it is the objective theme of our age. And then he said, "The present epoch," and this is just as true today, "the present epoch is great because the struggle that centers around the human person is ultimately a fight engaged under the banner of Christ." This was what he understood as the great mission of his life, to spread and deepen an understanding of the nature and dignity of the person. And of course, his wife continued that mission after he died. At the same time, she was inspiring Jules and me to want to join in that struggle for the human person. John Paul II was over in Rome unfolding before the world the same truth, focusing on it, the truth about the nature of the human being as made from love, made for love, called to give himself in love. This was, in a way, also the great mission of John Paul's papacy. He wrote to Henri de Lubac at one time, I'm convinced that the struggle of our time really lies exactly there for the dignity of the human person. It's not cosmological, it's not the nature of man, it is the nature and meaning of the human person. That's the battle of our time. He even described the communist ideology that was threatening the world, where he was a bishop at the time, as a pulverization of the human person. And this, I think, again, it's a common thread throughout his writings, the nature and dignity and vocation of the human person. This truth is what we could call the natural foundation on which the civilization of love has to be built. It is the same truth that is directly antagonized in the culture of death that is everywhere around us. We see all its hideous manifestations now becoming more and more apparent, more and more alarming in the world. And even though I think everyone here tonight would reject the culture of death, every one of us here would affirm the truth underlying the culture of life, that the human person is infinitely worthy, dignified, valuable, objectively good, objectively called to be with God. We all affirm that, but I think it's important for us to realize that we are affected very much by the evil philosophies that are prevailing right now in our culture, utilitarianism, relativism. As Alice von Hildebrand frequently has said to me, it's one of the refrains that has stayed with me, we've grown up breathing the air of feminism. We've grown up breathing the air of relativism. This has its effect on us. We should realize that it spiritually depresses us in a way. It makes it harder for us to flourish as persons. We find there are different ways I want to talk about that this happens. For one, we feel ourselves burdened by worries. We see people that we love being drawn into horrible behaviors or bad relationships or these kind. We suffer. We worry. We worry about the direction our country is going in and what is this going to mean for our children. We also find that these evil philosophies have really decimated the traditions and the kind of communities that used to ground and support human life. So we're bereft of those supports that our parents had and our grandparents had. And so it's all the more also than another factor we find, because utilitarianism has its grip on our society in such a way, what do we find? But we're all harassed with practical demands. We find ourselves running here and there. It's difficult ever to find the time to reflect the way we should. You know, philosophy is not for professional academics. Philosophy is for the human person. Each and every one of us is called on to reflect, to ask ourselves the deep questions of life. Who am I? What is my relation to God? What does he want of me? What is he asking of me? How can I serve my fellow man? These are the kinds of questions that we ought to be reflecting on. We need each other we have to help each other reflect on them. So that brings me around to the Personalist Project. I just want to say a few words about who we are and what we're about before I introduce Dr. von Hildebrand. Because it's so important that because we find ourselves in this state, and it's so important that we help one another deepen our grip on truth, we have founded the Personalist Project as a way of trying to do that. We wanted, first of all, to sort of brood on these insights that were left by such great philosophers as Dietrich von Hildebrand, Carol Wojtyła, John Paul II, and Cardinal Newman, Edith Stein, Soren Kierkegaard, others, to sort of receive and brood over these insights about the human person and to draw out their implications in dialogue with friends. Another thing we wanted to do is to sort of gather together these insights and be a resource for people who want to learn more, to study them, to understand them better. We wanted to engage the culture from the standpoint of the nature and dignity of the human person, begin to challenge the culture that wants to assert, for instance, that there's no difference between a homosexual liaison and a Christian marriage, or that there's nothing wrong with contraception, it's just a matter of opinion. To engage from the point of view, this deep truth about the human person, these kinds of issues, that's also part of our mission. And another very important part is to begin to form a community of friends. We need friends in this search for truth. It's not something that we can easily do on our own. Even something like picking up a book. I mean, how many of us know we should be reading serious books every once in a while to keep our intelligence alive? We don't get atrophied spiritually and mentally. Yet we find it hard. You know, you're tired at the end of the day. It's difficult to pick up a big philosophical book. So one of the things we do at the Personalist Project is gather once a month with friends at our home, and we read a book together. So we just finished reading Liturgy and Personality. We did Dietrich von Hildebrand's Liturgy and Personality. We do that in four sections, meeting once a month. We record the Jules' introduction to whichever section we're reading. We post that online so that members can sort of, whether they live near or at a distance, can listen in, participate, dialogue online, join our online forums. This is a way we can encourage one another. It's much easier to do philosophy when you're doing it with teachers and friends. So that's part of our aim also. And we wanted to do this beyond academia. Again, it's not just for philosophy, really is supposed to be normal for human beings. All of us are supposed to be seeking wisdom, and all of us are supposed to be sharing wisdom with one another. And finally, I just want to say, when we began the Personalist Project in 2007, we had a website, we started offering classes from our home, a reading circle, we started public lectures like this one tonight. We started as a nonprofit organization. And we found shortly that we had between us an insuperable aversion to fundraising. So this method of trying to do fundraising for the Personalist Project wasn't working. Now we're working with a new model. We thought, instead of asking people to give charity, there are so many worthy causes out there. Instead of asking people to give charity to keep us going, we thought what we want to do is provide a membership that's so enriching that the members want to pay for it, a modest, you know, like you pay for a membership to the Y, or you buy a book, or you buy a bottle of wine because it's valuable to you. So this is the sort of thing we're doing. We are now trying to build up the Personalist Project into a membership, a fellowship of people who love truth, want to meditate on the person in such a way that you find it enriching enough that you're happy to pay as a modest monthly thing. Right now, membership is free. So seize the opportunity. I urge you to go to our website, become a member if you want more of what you hear tonight from Dr. Von Hildebrand, and see if you find it enriching enough so that eventually when we start asking our members to, you know, spend a cup of coffee's worth of money a month to stay with us, you'll stay with us. So we'll see how that goes. All right, and now I just want to introduce Dr. Von Hildebrand. I think you all know her. You know her through her many books, through her many, many appearances on EWTN. You know that she has a gift for communicating love of truth, wit, wisdom, and you know also that she has been doing this for many, many decades. We are now just 2 days away from her 89th birthday. She's still giving us truth. So I want to express to her and in front of all of you my immense gratitude for her, for the gift of her in our lives, and for the blessing of having her with us tonight. So I give you Alice von Hildebrand.
Good evening. It is a pleasure to talk to you about one topic which is the most important in human life, the heart. When I was a child of 11 or 12, I had the blessing of reading a French taken called Pascal. I was 11 going on 12, and this reading made a tremendous impression on me. As a matter of fact, for a while, it was a vademecum. I carried Pascal with me wherever I went. And he says, man is the most amazing, baffling, surprising object in nature. What does he mean? Man is a mystery. He has a body and he has a soul. And the relationship between the two is not easy to explain. On top of it, his body is mortal and his soul is immortal. And to make things still more complicated, man was created by God, male and female. This creates another very dramatic difficulty, as we all know, because the relationship between man and woman is one of the most crucial ones in human existence. And finally, the human soul has three different faculties: intelligence, will, and the heart. That is to say, the affective life. This is going to be my topic tonight. What is the relationship existing between these three different faculties? We have intelligence, capable of knowing, understanding the world and other people and ourselves. We should not marvel at the fact that being so complicated, the way that God has made us, we have such difficulty understanding ourselves and such difficulty understanding others. Now, let us turn to the three main faculties of man: intelligence, free will, and emotional life, affective life, that I'm going to call the heart. In the whole history of philosophy, pride of place has been given to our intelligence. It's considered, so to speak, to be number one in the trinity of this faculty. And this for a very obvious reason, namely that it is impossible to will unless you know what you're willing. If I were to say to you, I will, I say, what do you mean? I don't know. It doesn't make any sense. You will something because you understand that it is attractive or that it is worth willing. Therefore, the will presupposes the intellect. And the same thing is true of our affective life. Suppose that someone were to come to you, I'm madly in love. And you say, with whom? You say, I don't know, I'm looking for her. That you are mad, because it is not possible to love if you don't know what is worth loving. Therefore, it is understandable that logically, the intellect comes first. Nevertheless, this is linked to a certain danger. And the danger is the following: to believe that man's intelligence is by far the highest and the most important thing in a human person. An overestimation of the intelligence at the price of saying the others are secondary or less important. It's a great danger in the history of humanity, and particularly in the history of philosophy, which almost inevitably leads to a certain rationalism. The man is dominant. This one thing, however, that we should not forget: the noble creature called man has been severely affected by original sin. This is true in many ways. For example, he has severely disrupted the relationship existing between man and woman. Many of the problems that we are facing are simply consequences of the original sin, that these two beings, so admirably made for each other, suddenly find in a state of conflict because they no longer accept the position that God has given them. So let us not forget that our intelligence has been affected by original sin. What does it mean? That even though the purpose of intelligence is to love and seek truth, why is it that when you study the history of philosophy, you see that we have fallen into innumerable errors? Our minds can mislead us, can cheat us, can betray us. And you will notice that this is something which is often overlooked in our admiration for the human intelligence. This is already mentioned in the Bible. You know, when the prophet says, well, you think and think, but you don't find the truth, for the very plain reason that you approach it in the wrong way. Philosophy started in the 5th century BC in a small country called Greece. And the amazing thing is that very early in the development of philosophy, Greece has given us three thinkers of such incredible greatness and nobility that up to today, we have a heavy debt of gratitude towards them: Socrates, that Plato lent the most noble man that ever lived or that I've ever known. Plato, this gigantic thinker, towards whom I have an enormous debt of gratitude, and Aristotle. They were giants of philosophical thought, but that let us not forget that the same Greece has offered us thinkers that have already injected philosophical poison from which we still suffer today. The great enemies of Socrates were the Sophists, and basically, you can say they were characterized by relativism. That is to say, to deny the objective value that things have and to simply devalue them by saying it's all relative. Benedict XVI said in his talk in Germany a few years ago, relativism is the cancer of our society. And you can see one of the cancers of our society, because it is an intellectual cancer, we are also suffering from very severe moral cancers. Now, the very moment that relativism seeps into thought, unfortunately, it turns out to be chronic. It is never completely overlooked. You can refute it, but you cannot quite defeat it, because once you have refuted it, it goes underground, and then after a while reappears. And this is why you look at the history of philosophy, you see that certain ideas have been refuted. It doesn't do any good. They continue to work and resurface. You know, because I got a PhD in philosophy, you work and work and have to pretend, or at least to give people the impression that you know the history of philosophy. All that you need to know is enough to get your PhD, but nevertheless your knowledge is very unsatisfactory. But I tell you something, to study the history of philosophy can be a very depressing experience, because apart from gigantic thinkers, to whom our debt is immense down the centuries, it is incredible the number of mistakes and errors that have been discovered by the human mind. You see, the problem is the following. There's only one truth. But if you want to be original, and to be original means to be famous, to be well known, to be acknowledged as a great thinker, you have a choice between thousands of errors. And if you want to become famous, you have a much better chance of doing so by inventing or renewing an error, and then people are going to say you're a great thinker or you're original. Whereas if you find a truth that everybody can find, provided that you're intelligent and truth-loving, what about it? There's nothing original or great. And from this point of view, the history of philosophy is a very depressing thing. There were moments of greatness. It's not like the history of science. It's not like the history of mathematics that progresses and it goes and it gets better and better, meaning to say a more thorough and a more perfect philosophic knowledge. In philosophy, it's up and down and up and down and up and down, very much like artistic production. You see, you think of Greece in the 15th century before Christ. I recall the first time I went to Athens and I saw the Parthenon. I had tears in my eyes. It is so overwhelmingly beautiful. It is ever new, because beauty transcends age. And then comes a moment of decadence. And I'm awfully sorry to say, today we seem to have reached as far as production ugliness is concerned. I think that we have a first prize. It seems to me that in many things that we do, beauty is no longer a concern. I just take one example, toys for children. I mean, I claim that most of them are so ugly that it's some sort of a sin to give it to a child. No, I mean it very seriously. And you know, as Plato says, the images that you get when you're a child mark you for life. because if you see beauty as a child, it's going to remain a standard, enabling you to pass judgment on other things. The history of philosophy is very depressing. There are great moments, there are magnificent moments, but starting in the 14th century, at the moment that scholasticism collapsed, it started going downhill. In the 15th and 16th century, there was practically nothing. There was relativism, there was elegant skepticism. There was a French thinker called Montaigne, and he would talk and talk and talk and then raise his hands and say, "What do I know?" And then, of course, he's loudly applauded. Well, that's another story. In the 17th century, Descartes decided that philosophy had to be revived, and he made some important contributions. Unfortunately, they were mixed to misformulation, misinterpretations, and downhand errors. It's not easy for the human man to totally escape from errors. No, I tell you something which is very sad, which is a law. If a philosopher makes some important contributions, but there are some errors, the errors are going to influence the next philosopher, not the true things. And I have an extremely simple explanation for it. Many diseases are contagious. Health is not. Let me repeat this. It's a sad law in human life. If you have a contagious infection and I come and do not protect myself, I'll catch it. You're not going to catch my health. Same thing in the history of philosophy. Whatever weaknesses or defects there were in Descartes were immediately endorsed, inherited, and developed by the successors. And I mean, this is why you can truly say that in the 17th century, after Descartes, 18th century, 19th century, philosophy produced an incredible number of what I'm going to call brilliant errors. If you err, make sure that it is brilliant, because then it will guarantee your fame for the rest of your life and forever. What do I mean by a brilliant error? That it is false is totally secondary. What is striking is a formulation which is witty, a formulation which is deep, and so on. I have taught for 37 years in a secular university. I don't know how much my students have learned from me, but I've learned a lot from my students. Because, you know, the City University of New York being a melting pot, I had students from every part of the world. I heard every possible foreign accent. I truly had an insight into a great variety of cultures. It is absolutely amazing to see how people are impressed by what is new, by what is brilliant, or by what is complicated. Now, it comes to one of the great dangers of philosophy. I do not say that these famous philosophers, which to my mind have been a disaster from many, many points of view, I don't say that they were not intelligent, but intelligence which is not put at the service of truth is the worst thing that you can possibly imagine, because you impress people, and in many cases, and I mean this seriously, you impress them because they use a language which is so complicated, which is so cryptic, that people say, "That must be profound." I recall, she was not very bright, a student coming to me and raving about a professor. I don't think he ever knew what he was talking about, and I never knew why he was teaching philosophy. After years and years of being his colleague, it remained a mystery to me. And he said, "You know, this man is magnificent. He goes up and up and up and up in the clouds. No one understands what he says. It's sublime." It is ridiculous, but it is true. why are people impressed by Kant? Because he's so complicated that you have to tear your hair to understand what he's talking about. You know, I recall we had a friend, a Jesuit, and he said to my husband, you know, I read Kant in French because then I have some hope of understanding what he's talking about. Because, I mean, German has a peculiarity of having sentence about this long, and the verb is at the very end. And by the time you come to the very end, you forgot what it's all about, and you have to reread it. Well, French is an incredibly rational language. It is a language of reason because it's very close to the Latin. And Latin is an incredibly logical and clear language. So I say, beware of people whose language is so complicated that you are cheated into believing that it is deep. There is a real depth, and there is a disastrous depth. Now, just to show to you that one of the big problems that we are facing is that for centuries long, that is to say, 18th, 19th century, philosophy has been a disaster. You've heard Locke, Berkeley, Hume, Kant, Hegel, Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, Marx, and you can see from one mistake to another until we find ourselves in a state of mental and intellectual confusion that is extraordinarily dangerous from a moral point of view. Now, beware of false brilliance. Beware of people that are eloquent, but who are not truly lovers of the truth. Now, take, for example, the confusion in which we live today. When you have someone teaching at Princeton University, and rightly or wrongly, let me repeat, rightly or wrongly, it is called a very great university. You know, because sometimes people live on the fame of their ancestors. You know, you have an aristocratic ascendancy and you remain an aristocrat, even though maybe you're very unaristocratic in your behavior. All right, let us say it was a great university, and today one of their professors is Peter Singer. Now, when you understand that a university professor who is very famous, who is making the headlines, who is writing books, tries to convince you that a chimpanzee, a healthy chimpanzee, is superior to a human being, a baby, that has some sort of defect, in this very moment, you should ring the alarm, because it simply shows that we are intellectually and morally on a downward trend, which is going to lead us to an abyss unless we wake up. You know, because my background is French, I have a French sense of humor. And I imagine, you know, sometimes when I go to sleep and I have all these crazy ideas, that what Peter Singer might do yet, he's still alive, might do yet, is to apply to a huge American foundation and to collect money for the foundation of the first chimpanzee university in the United States. I assure you, he will get money. Because, I mean, after all, isn't it fascinating to discover that maybe chimpanzee could get a BA and MA, and with time, might get a PhD and carry the hat. We live in a world of intellectual madness. And there's a program on EWTN about Chesterton called The Father of Common Sense. I cannot tell you how refreshing it can be to me when I speak to simple people with no particular education who know that 2 + 2 = 4. For years and years, I had a cleaning lady, a black woman, lovely, sound, kind, trustworthy, whatever you please. And I truly enjoyed talking to her. As a matter of fact, from time to time, I reread part of my talk. And one day I said to her, but Alberta, you seem to have all the right ideas. It's such a pleasure to talk to you. She cuts me short. She said, you know, Mrs. von Liederbrand, I have not been ruined by education. I left school in the third grade. I mentioned her on television because you can be ruined by getting an education. Because the moment you enter school and you are told that everything is relative, there's no good and there's no evil, you know, all a matter of approach, a matter of culture, a matter of how you feel about it, in this very moment, you destroy the child by the time he's six. It's all very good to speak of education, but an education that is not based on the love and pursuit of truth is a disaster. Much better to be just a very simple person because, you know, when you cultivate the earth, when you're a peasant, you have no time for nonsense. The nonsense is intellectual nonsense. The nonsense is due to pride that man believes that his mind is characterized by the fact that it cannot err. And therefore, whatever enters your mind is something that is to be thought of and appreciated. Now, enough said about intelligence. If at the service of truth, it is an enormous gift that God has given us. But let us keep in mind that it is wounded by original sin. And this is why I usually say, my intelligence, in order to work properly in fundamental questions such as the meaning of life, is there a God, is there an eternal life, and so on and so on, must be baptized. And I mean by baptized, purified. Purified by humility and realize we do make mistakes. You take the greatest thinkers, these giants of human thoughts, they have their weaknesses. And therefore, we have to be on the lookout, and we are only protected by intellectual humility. Now comes the will. The will is typical of the dignity of a human person, to be able to make choices for which are totally and completely responsible. It is your responsibility. It's typical of personhood. It's inconceivable that you'll call yourself a person and have no free will. I will. Now, this is a tremendous gift. And Kierkegaard wrote these very meaningful words. He says, only an infinitely powerful and loving God could dare give human beings free will because they could misuse it. And he did take this chance because he wanted to be loved freely. If you are forced to love, you do not love. Love has to be a free gesture. It's all very good, but the question is that my free will has also been affected by original sin. I still have it. But we have to be extremely careful that our free will does not just become self-will, meaning to say what I want, what I like, what I approve of, with no regard whatever with the object that I'm related to. Recently, I have written a long essay, not published as yet, comparing the memoirs of Edith Stein, the famous German woman who was Jewish, converted to Catholicism and died in a concentration camp. Certainly one of the very, very great women of the 20th century, combining a remarkable intelligence and then afterwards to truly a love of God and sainthood. She wrote her memoirs and stopped at the age she was 26 when she stopped it. I read it two or three times in German. And my husband, at my request, also wrote his memoirs. They were born on the same day, except that my husband was born 2 years earlier. And what I did do was to compare my husband's youth to Edith Stein's youth. And it's fascinating. because their backgrounds were radically and totally different. Totally different. In the sense that my husband came from a famous family. His father was a very great sculptor, probably the greatest sculptor in Germany of the 19th century. And, you know, superb background, living in Florence for most of his youth, having a magnificent house in Munich, high culture, knowing big tops in philosophy and in art and in literature and the rest of it. She came from a modest family of very hard-working people, the last of 11 children. And the father died when she was young, and the mother took over the timber business, courageous, very devoted Jewish woman going to the synagogue. Now, what is interesting is that Edith writes in her memoirs that when she was a small child, the youngest, her will was already so strong that she would challenge her mother and her siblings. She wanted something and she wanted it. And she would yield an inch. And even if she was punished, she would not yield a yinish. And then she would go into tantrums. And when they wanted to punish her and put her in a dark closet or something, she stiffened herself and she couldn't move her. And then one of the fair days, she realized that she was creating havoc in the family, that there was no peace in the family when there's constant fighting, and she overcame it. But she kept her strong will. In my husband, you find something very similar. That until he was 6 or 7, the youngest of a family of 6, preceded by 5 sisters, he had his will. And when you say, I will, that is the end story, so to speak. It's not easy for parents to bring up a child whose will is so strong that their babies, toddlers, already say no. It's not easy to handle. Now, Edith kept it, but instead of going into tantrums, she put her whole will in being an intellectual success. She entered school, and from the moment she entered school, she was the best in everything. She did not want to be good, she wanted to excel, and she did by 2 things: her intelligence and her will. You know, you can have intelligence, but you're very lazy. It's not going to lead you far. But she had both, and she succeeded. Now, something amazing is related in her memoirs. She was the best of the best of the best of the best, summa cum laude, A plus, A plus, A plus, considered to be a fault. And then, at the age of 20 or 21, she went to the University of Göttingen, a very high level intellectual. And all of a sudden, she realized that she was competing with people of high intelligence and no longer felt, I'm quoting her, that I could control everything by my will. She was absolutely overwhelmed. My will can no longer achieve whatever I want. It reached such a point because she wanted to excel, and she said she couldn't make it, that she writes in her memoirs, and you would hardly believe this. She was loved by her mother. She was successful in whatever she achieved. And she said, I reached such a point of despair that every time I crossed the street, I was hoping that a bus would overrun me and I would die. Now, just to show you the power of the human will. But then if you read the life of Saint Benedict, he will tell you that one of the main aims in monastic life is to conquer your self-will. And this is precisely what happens to people taking a vow of obedience, that you will one thing and you have to will to conquer your own will. This is not easy to do, but now let us look at the effect in philosophy. I told you a little while ago that in order for you to make a choice, you need to know. And therefore, the precedence that intelligence has over free will. Now, look what happens. My intelligence informs me about many things. And now my will can choose. And in this very moment, because of original sin, I might choose, freely choose or decide to choose, not what is good, not what is true, but what I happen to like subjectively. Now, there was a turn in the history of philosophy that you find in the 19th century, that all of a sudden, intelligence is considered to be at the service of the will. You find this in the terrible words of Nietzsche. You know, a man who was very talented, extremely intelligent, but intelligence doesn't help you when your moral attitude is perverted. I'm to give you two quotes, to give you that the will takes precedence over the intelligence. I'm quoting, "My will said to my intelligence, 'This cannot be,' and my intelligence yielded. 'I don't want this to exist,' and my intelligence tells me it exists, and I don't want it to exist, and therefore it doesn't exist." Worse than that, Nietzsche declares his atheism, and he says, "It's not a question of proof. It's not that I have disproved God's existence. It's a question of will. I don't want him to be." And then he develops it by saying, "If they were gods, how could I stand not to be God myself? And therefore it doesn't exist." You see the perversion of man's will. And it becomes totally distorted and almost diabolical. Now comes the heart. Now you can see the heart has always been looked down upon. And the great Aristotle has some responsibility. I say the great Aristotle because I'm far from denying his genius, but keep in mind that genius are not necessarily protected from error. Aristotle writes in his Ethics, or in one of his books, he's written quite many of them, "What makes man to be superior to animals is his intelligence and his will. Feelings are things that he shares with animals." Dear Aristotle, I hope you cried in your tomb for writing these words, because he's creating a tremendous equivocation, one of the main sources of error in philosophy. Equivocation. Because the word feeling has different meanings and very different meanings. If you mean a physical sensation, for example, I say I have a toothache. Where is it? In my tooth. And where is the tooth? In my mouth. And I can locate the pain. So can an animal have physical pain. An animal is wounded, and the pain is in his leg or whatever it is. There's a physical location, and you know the pain is caused by a harm done to your body. This is something that man shares with animals, even though my husband would say the pain suffered by an animal and the pain suffered by a person can be two very different things. Because being a person, everything can be brought to a higher level. But let's leave this aside. There's also such a thing as psychic feelings. This is something which is so admirably developed in my husband's book that all that I can do is to say to you, read it. Read it contemplatively. Don't rush to it. It's not a novel. but it is so enriching for your personal life, for your religious life, for intellectual life, that it is worth the effort. Psychic feelings, radically different from physical feelings, which have a physical location in my body, my foot or my tooth or whatever it might be. A psychic feeling has no physical location. It's not in my foot, it's not in my arm, it's not in my finger, it's not in my head. It is psychic. The mystery about psychic feelings is that you certainly have them, and you cannot necessarily say what causes them. In some cases, you can know, for example, that you drink a bit too much, and you get jolly, and you start laughing without any reason. And then you can trace it back and say, every time I drink too much, I have this psychic, and you laugh, and you laugh, and there's no reason for laughing. You make yourself ridiculous, but, I mean, because you are tipsy. It can also have a purely biological cause, such as women after giving birth, there's a certain percentage that fall into deep depression. And they love the baby, but all of a sudden everything is dark and everything is sad, and they cry and cry and cry. And it is because of a hormonal change. In that case, you need medical help. People will tell you that artists are very moody. My beloved brother-in-law, the composer of the beautiful opera, The Birds, was very moody, was a great artist, and very moody. And one very fine day, he just was in a bad mood. And he could be very jolly and very gay, but when he was in a bad mood, it was no fun. And his children then feared him. And then, in fact, he had an artificial bird with a long, long beak. And when they came to the breakfast table, if the beak was down, it said, "That is in a bad mood. Behave properly." Whereas if the beak was up, they could make any nonsense and they wouldn't care. It was terribly, you know, up and down and up and down, which is typical of certain artists, I don't know. But then comes feelings of a person. And don't forget that man's greatness is due to the fact that he's made to God's image and existence, and God is a person. The moment you reach this level, you reach a totally, radically different level. Feelings in these cases are responses. For example, someone that you love is undergoing great suffering, and you grieve with and for him. It's a conscious response to something calling for a response of grief. Suppose that you hear that someone who was in a state of despair suddenly has found truth and is out of it, was committing or threatening to commit suicide, and all of a sudden is out of it. You rejoice. Once again, it's a proper response to what has happened. Now, if you read the book on the heart, you're going to see that my husband was one of the great advocates of the greatness of the heart. I mean, as a matter of fact, if you read his works, you're going to see that love plays an absolutely prominent role in all his works. Simultaneously, he had the objectivity of saying that the heart too can derail. And there are several chapters in the book on the heart showing that the heart can derail in certain ways. And all of them are regrettable, because they offer a caricature of what is best and most noble in us, our heart. Because our heart is ourselves. Recently, I do a lot of reading, and I read something so beautiful that I wanted to share it with you. God is the eternal heart, because God is love. Suppose that you fall in love with a girl, and you say to this girl, "I want to marry you. I give you my intelligence. Unless he's an idiot, he should turn you down. You can't give your intelligence to another person. But what do you say to a person that you love? I give you my heart. Because the heart is myself in this very moment. Intelligence, will, and spiritual feelings are united. Because when you love, you know whom you love. When you love, you sanction your love with your will. You not only say, I love, but I seal it with my will. I make it something which is steady. Of course, our relationship to our heart is something very complicated. Hearts are complicated because we don't have the control of our heart that we have of our will. I'm responsible for what I do. But what about my feelings? Many of us can be plagued by feelings that we do not have to have, we don't want to have. You know, for example, I claim that a feeling of jealousy is not a very pleasant feeling to have, and all of a sudden you have it. I cannot command my love. I cannot command compassion. I cannot even command contrition. But nevertheless, and once again, if you get acquainted with the beautiful contributions of my husband, you can say, you cannot do something directly. There are things you can do indirectly. Number one, suppose, for example, that you have a feeling of envy. You see someone is much better off, or someone is more handsome, whatever it might be, you feel envy. One thing is to say, well, it's just too bad. I have not chosen to be envious, and it's not my fault. I have nothing to do with it. And the second is to realize that as a person, you can take position towards your envy and you say, I happen to have this feeling, but it is illegitimate, it is wrong, and I disavow it. I disavow it, meaning to say I refuse to recognize it as my valid response to the object. In this very moment, you have killed the plant. It cannot grow because you simply refuse to recognize it. Same thing if you have a feeling of enthusiasm. If you don't say, my feeling of enthusiasm is justified by the object, and you sanction it, you say, it is man. Like the statues in Daedalus, you know, in Greek, there was some sort of a legend that they were magnificent statues. And if you did not nail them to the sock, they'll fly off. This is true of our feelings. You have a feeling of contrition. You have offended another person, and you feel contrite. Unless you go and you apologize, and you simply say, I felt so contrite that I had tears in my eyes, but you don't correct the mistake that you've made, it's gone. Feelings, from this point of view, are what are the deepest in us, but we need a collaboration with God in order for them to become alive. You see, basically, what is Christian life? The purification of the heart. That is to say, every single moment, to compare, to relate to the heart of Christ. And if you read the magnificent litany of Christ, the litany of a sacred heart, you're going to see that there, if you live it, if you pursue it, if you seek after it, if you long for it, all of a sudden, you're going to become what you would like to be, a real image of God. Thank you.